Welcome to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast, part of the center's efforts to cultivate dialogue about university teaching and learning among faculty, students, and staff. I'm your host, Rhett McDaniel, educational technologist here at the center. In this episode, we feature four panelists: Jack Barkenbus, Senior Research Associate at the Vanderbilt Institute for Energy and Environment; James Clark, Professor of the Practice for Civil and Environmental Engineering; Cecilia Tichy, the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of English; and Beth Conklin, Associate Professor of Anthropology. The panel talks about the disciplinary and interdisciplinary opportunities and challenges promoted by tackling complex environmental problems in the classroom.
Our first speaker today will be Jack Barkenbus. Dr. Barkenbus is a political scientist and researcher who joined Vanderbilt in 2006. He's currently the Associate Director of the Climate Change Research Network, affiliated with the Vanderbilt Institute for Energy and Environment. He received his PhD at the University of Denver and his BA at Kalamazoo College. Dr. Barkenbus is also the director of THESA, the Tennessee Higher Education Sustainability Association. I'll let Jack talk a little bit more about this himself, but over the next several days, Trebekah Nazarene will host this year's THESA conference that'll continue the discussion that we're beginning today. So, Jack's career is focused on the interface of energy technologies and institutions. Prior to joining Vanderbilt, he was the executive director of the Energy, Environment, and Resources Center at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Dr. Barkenbus also served 10 years as senior scientist for the Institute for Energy Analysis in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Prior to moving to East Tennessee, he was employed by Johns Hopkins University and at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California. He also served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Turkey for 3 years in the late 60s. And he's got several publications that have come out recently about CO2 savings and technology. So I'll let him begin.
Okay. Thank you, John. This is my favorite topic, sustainability. But I must confess, I'm not teaching anything. As you heard John say, I'm a researcher. So I think my capacity here today is really as the executive director of this nonprofit organization that I helped form, Tennessee Higher Education Sustainability Association. That was formed about 5 years ago in order to promote sustainability in Tennessee higher education institutions. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but I'll provide a little context for today's meeting, even if I won't talk about instruction too much. The USA News in January said sustainability had arrived on college campuses. The article said that more than 100 majors, minors, and certificates were created in 2009, as opposed to only three in 2005. And while I admit that this topic is gaining ground on college campuses, I think at this stage it's a bit overhyped. If you look at some of those new programs that have been created, many of them are just compilations of existing programs put in a different format so that it can say sustainability or an environmental major and involve relatively little new instruction. So one has to be careful about reading press reports on this kind of thing. I always remember I went to my first greening conference about 15 years ago. And I felt a little embarrassed because my institution had done relatively little in this respect, and here I was with the Dukes and the Emerys of the world. But then a keynote speaker was David Orr, who is somewhat of a sustainability guru for higher education. And he said, look, he said, what's happened so far is very nice, but we're really at the Kitty Hawk stage of this sustainability movement right now. We're about 5 feet above the ground. That's where we are. And we got a long ways to go. So don't feel bad if you haven't done much today. And I think we've gone beyond the kitty, to maintain the metaphor, we've gone beyond the Kitty Hawk stage, but we're not quite into the jet engine stage yet. We're still at the old propeller stage. And so I think there's a lot more that we can do and will do over time. Now, sustainability on campuses is usually expressed in both what's happening on the campus itself and in the classroom. And these tend to be separate endeavors. And I would submit we're much further along in our campus operations in terms of sustainability than we are in the classroom. And there's good reasons for that. Sometimes you can even save money by the sustainability route through campus operations. And what organization can better afford the upfront costs than an institution that's going to be around for decades? And so there's no excuses, really, for colleges to not take things that are expensive in the short term but pay off in the long term. So it makes sense financially to do many things consistent with sustainability on the campus. Plus, campuses want to be role models for the community, and they really look upon the sustainability. Many college presidents see it as a marketing tool. You want to get the best and the brightest coming to your school. You want to hype the what's happening in your campus and make them feel proud of that campus. And so it's a marketing tool in many ways. So for all of these reasons, the operations part of sustainability is taking off. But what we're here today to talk about is more of the classroom situation. And I would submit that progress has been a little bit more measured in that regard. You know, most of the faculty aren't familiar with sustainability and its major tenets. And they, even if they are familiar, they can be quite suspicious of it, feeling that, oh, this is the next fad that's going across higher education. We've had fads before. This is going to fade. Why should I bother my classroom with these concepts? So there's that attitude and just the natural resistance of the teaching community to change whatever they are comfortable in teaching. There has been the growth of specialized programs, environmental science majors and minors, and some sustainability things. But what they tend to do is they tend to take those students that naturally gravitate towards the environmental issue and make them stronger and do all good things for those people, but they tend to leave the rest of the campus where most of the students are, you know, to themselves. So we're not getting sustainability spread across the campus, or what I would say, we're not seeing sustainability incorporated as a core value across the entire curriculum, and yet it has the potential to be that. Many people have recognized that, and there actually is a model for begin introducing sustainability as a core value across the curriculum. It's called the Ponderosa model, or alternatively the Piedmont model. And interestingly, the founder of this model, Paul Rowland, is going to be in Nashville tomorrow. He's going to be at our thesis conference, taking place at Tribeca Nazarene University. And if you haven't signed up for the conference, just see me after the session, and I can register for you. For students, we waive the registration fee. Plus, there's free food. So that should be an inducement. You do have to find Tribeca. I don't know how many people know where Tribeca is, but there'll be plenty of parking available at the site. But tomorrow night, we're going to have a speaker who's written a book. Oh, gosh, I forgot the name of it. But anyway, it's dealing with renewable energy, and she's an environmental science a reporter, and it's supposed to be quite a nice book and presentation. And then Thursday morning, Paul Rowland, who, as I say, is the founder of this Ponderosa model, will give a talk. How much he's going to talk about the model remains to be seen, but because he's really the executive director of the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education. Now, that's a mouthful. It's called ASHI, And if you want, you should find it if you're interested, because it's the organization involved in spreading sustainability across campuses. And their website is aashe.org, ashe.org. Well, he's the executive director based in Denver, and he's coming to the meeting to talk about giving a better talk than I can about how sustainability is or isn't moving across campuses across the United States. So as I say, we'd welcome you to attend that conference and just come up to me afterwards and say you're interested and I can help you out. But anyway, this Ponderosa model is essentially what it involves is organizing summer workshops for faculty. It's usually 2 days or maybe a little bit longer, where you send out an announcement across faculty and say, we're going to have a workshop on sustainability for the purpose of teaching you how to incorporate sustainability within your discipline. Many people don't know how sustainability relates to history, to English. Most of them are familiar with it in terms of environmental sciences, but if you look at the basic tenets of sustainability, you can find ways to introduce it into your history classes, English classes, you name it, whatever, across the university. In most cases, universities that have gone this way find a number of faculty who want to attend these things. They are self-selected participants, but they generally want to learn how to introduce sustainability into their discipline and their classroom. And this is what that workshop is for. Last month, THESA held a one-day workshop where we brought in Lindy Biggs from Auburn to talk to the group about the audience that came from statewide institutions. There were 45, 50. People attending, talk about how to hold one of these workshops. And she has held it on the campus of Auburn University for 4 or 5 years, and about 80 faculty members have gone through these workshops. And her informal estimate is that about 80% of those who have gone through this workshop feel capable and willing to introduce sustainability into their classroom in subsequent years. So it's a bottoms-up approach to getting sustainability into the curriculum that seems to have some appeal. I don't think we're at the stage now where we can have a top-down edict from high, the administration, saying, aha, all you faculty members need to do this. I don't think it would work. I think the bottom-up approach is fine. It just will take longer than, obviously, a top-down one. So in short, I'm optimistic about the introduction of sustainability into the curriculum, but recognize that it may take longer than some of us may wish. But there are models out there to do it, and we hope to disseminate those models in Tennessee over the coming years. So that's my introduction, John. I'll be happy to take questions later.
Thanks, Jack, for setting that up for us. Mm-hmm. So our second panelist is Cecilia Tichy. Professor Tichy is the William R. Keenan Professor of English at Vanderbilt University. She received her MA from Johns Hopkins University and her PhD from the University of California, Davis in 1968. Before coming to Vanderbilt in 1987, she taught at Boston University, and at Vanderbilt she teaches classes in 19th and 20th century American literature, focusing on aspects of culture from consumerism and social critique to country music. Over the past decade, her courses and research have focused on civic engagement and the writers who summon us to it, from the certified literary to investigative journalists. Her relevant publications extend from the beginning of her career and to her contemporary work, and include New World, New Earth, Environmental Reform in American Literature from the Puritans to Whitman, What Democracy Looks Like, A New Critical Realism for a Post-Seattle World, and Civic Passions, Seven Who Launched Progressive America and What They Teach Us, which was just published last year.
Hi, thank you, John. Let me mention that my secondary appointment is that of Professor of American Studies, and very often do I sign that first at the bottom of whatever letter or document I'm generating. I'm about to make a few of what I suppose I would call back office remarks about sustainability. Preparing for our own discussion this afternoon in a class earlier today, in which we're reading a book about prisons. It's called Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. And you know, we imprison, I think, more than the next eight industrialized nations together. An overwhelming percentage of our incarcerated are in for nonviolent drug offenses. And now that we have a private prison industry with stocks on the New York Exchange, where students looked it up this afternoon, it was trading Corrections Corporation of America at $11.23. So reading this book by a Wall Street Journal investigative reporter, and the students are well into it and have learned from Joseph Hallinan, the author, what a colossal waste of money and human beings our prison system is. Rehabilitation was just about canceled out in the 1980s, so it's just long, hard time, and the gangs run the prisons, and there are murders, and there's complicity of guards now and then, and so on and so on. Some prisoners, to save their own lives, create a sufficient disturbance about themselves that they are assigned to solitary confinement, where they have only a sprinkling of little holes in the door to see anything out. The prison's designed so they see nothing but gray. So I asked the class, what do you think when you hear the word sustainability? Well, one of them said, we read about that one prison where they grow crops and they eat their crops, and that defrays the cost of maintenance and so on. And then there was a pause, and then there was something else about finance of prisons. And then the conversation sort of died. I had to guide them into the content of the very book that they were reading, because they heard the word sustain, and they thought only of, as one student said, the environment, meaning grass and trees and the oceans and brooks and so on, but nothing about our social infrastructure and the economy that benefits some and is horrendously destructive for others. So it seems to me that if we are serious about considering that term, the key term of this afternoon, in its larger implications, then we have to talk about our food system that is not just, you know, not just row crops and field crops and the livestock as pictured in the supermarket. We have to get into those slaughterhouses and see what's going on, and see what's going on with the E. coli that sickens so many every year. We have to see what the prison system is doing to our fellow citizens and the economy. Because if I ask what do we want as citizens, the students say, of course, we want rehabilitation, we want people out and living profitable lives for themselves and in relation to us. And then I say, what do we want if we have stock in the prison corporations? And of course they say, we want our stock to go up. And how is that? Well, we want, that means more people. Yes, I say. We're trafficking in human bodies for the sake of our stock rises. And so the we have to look at the clash between our investment selves and our civic selves, and the antithesis there. And it seems to me we have to look at, we're all, maybe some of us at least, pleased that there's some step taken toward a health care reform, but so much more to go, and we have to be bearing that in mind And it seems to me we need as well to look at our military adventures and the cost of militarism. And just for the sake of the usual word of sustainability, it is the military's testing of rocketry that's poisoned water all around the country with perchlorate. The military is trying to get an exemption so they're not responsible for any of the costs of cleanup. Pasadena, where of course Caltech is located, and where the students have been drinking out of glass bottles and stainless steel for the last several years, is in its groundwater contaminated with perchlorate from Rocketdyne and other companies. So I would just say that it seems to me unless we're willing to have our students and our colleagues take satisfaction in the recycle bins and the, you know, and maybe a switch to glass and steel drinking bottles at the expense of the public supply that comes out of the fountains, the water fountains. Unless we're satisfied with that level of sustainability, we need to broaden the definition and consider the structures of the society we're living in now and regard our imperative for remediation. End of my statement.
Up next, we'll have Professor Jim Clark, who's Professor of Practice in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. Professor Clark received his PhD in theoretical chemistry from Johns Hopkins University and his BA in chemistry from Rockford College. Dr. Clark has over 30 years of experience in the investigation and remediation of contaminated sites, the environmental fate and transport of chemicals and radionuclides, environmental assessment, hazardous and radioactive waste management, environmental forensics, and the long-term management of legacy nuclear and hazardous waste sites. His research interests include risk analysis, long-term management of nuclear and hazardous waste sites, environmental containment transport, contaminant transport, sustainable environmental protection, and environmental forensics. He's got several articles relevant to today's discussion, including a sustainable environmental protection system for management of residual contaminants, containment of legacy waste during stewardship, and engineered containment and control systems nurturing nature.
Thanks. As John told you, the area I spent most of my career in is environmental restoration, hazardous waste sites, nuclear waste sites, things of that nature. Before joining the faculty at Vanderbilt full-time, I came here as a postdoc in a former life and then went into private practice for 25 years in the company that I was with was instrumental in, I hate to say cleaning up, because we don't clean these sites up. We do the best we can with them, and then we try to keep the bad stuff from getting out, and we try to keep the people from getting in. So it's kind of where we are. In the early 90s, I started working on radioactive waste sites through the National Academy of Science. Went around to all the major Department of Energy sites. And just to give you some perspective, I think it was in 1994, the Secretary of Energy estimated that the legacy of nuclear weapons and the Manhattan Project and the Cold War was going to cost us on the order of $1 trillion. And that was to do the best we could with these sites and try to take them to an acceptable level of risk, whatever you would call an acceptable level of risk. The Secretary of Energy had a massive heart attack, is probably not strong enough, and that number got revised to $300 billion within about an hour. And that's about where it stands right now. The Environmental Management Division of the Department of Energy has a $6 billion budget. This year, they just got another $6 billion through the stimulus package. A lot of that money goes to Hanford, but it kind of gets spread around to all the sites. Now, just to give you a little more perspective, my perspective, and then I did bring some slides, because I think I cannot convey to you the challenge we have without showing you some pictures. So I hope I can do that in about take too long. It may turn into a movie. But in any event, after 25 years of working in the private sector, coming up with and implementing approaches to restoring contaminated sites to the best we could, and managing them long term, which is really the challenge, and that's where we get into sustainability. In the middle 90s or so, it struck me that all the things we were doing were simply not sustainable. What do I mean by that? Well, one of my favorite definitions of sustainability is that we make decisions that do not compromise people who come behind us. Well, what are we doing with all these contaminated sites? We're trying to lock up the contamination as best we can through covers over landfills and vaults and different technologies, but with the recognition, and we didn't have the recognition initially, but we certainly have it now, that what we were doing was hoping to violate the second law of thermodynamics at no additional cost. Nature doesn't like things all nice and tidy in one place and has a lot of natural processes to disperse them. So if we were going to keep this stuff where we put it, we would have to have long-term maintenance, and we would have to have long-term monitoring. Many of the radionuclides have half-lives of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions of years. Many of the hazardous chemicals don't decay at all, the heavy metals. So we're putting ourselves into a situation where we're really locking in future generations to maintain these sites and to monitor them. The Department of Energy very cavalierly will tell you that they expect this monitoring to go on in perpetuity. Well, I don't think Congress understands in perpetuity, so I'm not real assured by that. So my research for the past several years has been focused on how could we make these technologies more sustainable. I think that's the best we can do, is make them more sustainable. I mean, in terms of my definition, if you had unlimited resources, sustainability wouldn't be an issue. But we don't have unlimited resources. And we really don't want to compromise decisions through our decisions of people that come after us can make. So that's kind of, you know, my introduction. If I could squeeze by you and just show you a few pictures.
Am I in the thing?
Not in it, but you may want to see, so you can see it.
Oh, my stuff.
When I first got into the private sector, I was with a consulting firm, and we're in the definition of an expert. An expert is out of town. And an expert has slides. And in those days, we did in fact have slides, those little 2x2 guys. Okay, so I frame my comments around sustainability. What does it mean? I've just kind of told you my concept of it. More importantly, for this workshop, I think, what does it mean within the context of my research? And now, how could I take that and incorporate it into my teaching? And that's what I've been trying to do for the past few years. This is the legacy of waste management process or practices, where we simply dump stuff into low-lying areas and then threw some soil over it and hoped it would stay there. This is the Idaho National Laboratory. Actually, they prettied it up by stacking the drums, and they're trying not to injure anybody here. And then they found that the workers were getting much higher radiation doses stacking the drums, so they went back to just rolling it off the truck. This is a modern contamination isolation facility where we take an engineered approach. We do keep it in drums. We might solidify it, so hopefully it doesn't leach. We put covers over the top. We put liners under the bottom. And what we don't want to happen is that this stuff gets out, gets into the groundwater. That's the usual pathway, or if we're dealing with radon or gases, that it gets into the atmosphere. So we're using engineered barriers, and then we're using natural barriers that are in the environment. So simply we would put some engineered cover over it. And if we're doing a new facility, we have the opportunity to put a bottom that will hold and enable us to collect any water that gets into the waste while the site is open, and then hopefully we'll keep water from moving through the waste after the site is closed. And this is the typical resistive cover. I put resistive in quotes because I think what we're trying to do is we're really trying to fight Mother Nature. Is there a better way to do this? We put a cover over the top, soil cover, and then this is a plastic, if you will. It's a so-called a synthetic geomembrane that has very low permeability, and then we put a compacted clay over that. This is called a composite cover, and we hope water doesn't get through it, because if water gets into the waste, then all these processes that can mobilize the hazardous and radioactive constituents kick in. And you can see how what they're doing is compacted the clay, and now they're putting the plastic over the top. And that's a conventional approach, and the company I was with designed and implemented these at Superfund sites all across the country. I guess hoping they would last. When you put this in the context of the environment, here's our contamination isolation facility, and here's everything that nature is trying to do to disrupt what we spent millions of dollars doing. We have to deal with animal intrusion, biodegradation, plant intrusion, erosion, both water and wind, and there are just several processes that are fighting us. And so we have to maintain these facilities, and we have to monitor them for a long time. The stuff that's in there may last thousands to hundreds of thousands of years, and water tends to be the main pathway to get to the waste and get it out. So this is what's called a water balance model. So don't fight Mother Nature. A colleague of mine, Jody Wa, who works at the Office of Legacy Management in Grand Junction, Colorado, kind of opened my eyes and said, you know, we really need to design these systems to accommodate natural processes, not to resist them, and to accommodate natural change. We're trying to project out, well, the Yucca Mountain Project went on 1 million years. It's insane. Low-level waste, 10,000 years. Uranium mill tailings, 1,000 years. These are the so-called compliance times. Well, here's a way that doesn't fight Mother Nature. We put a soil sponge in, and we put plants on top of it, maybe even trees. And during the growing season, there's a process called evapotranspiration that will actually release any water that comes in back into the atmosphere through the plants and through normal evaporation. And then during the non-growing season, we've got this sponge to hold the water. And what we don't want to happen is the water makes it through and then gets into the waste. So this is called evapotranspiration or the water balance cover. A friend of mine in Wisconsin calls it a store and release cover. I think those are all pretty good terms. But this is a way of trying to accommodate these natural processes and not put an engineered structure in here to try to resist them. We have a student who's going to defend her thesis on this Thursday. How do we evaluate these systems? How do we project them out to 1,000 years or 10,000 years? We do what's called a performance assessment, where we look at all the different processes that can take place and all the pathways that can take the chemicals down to places where they would be released, and then look at exposure scenarios and corresponding risk. This is called a performance assessment. We spend millions of dollars doing these performance assessments naively, convincing ourselves that we can project out to these very long time periods. Well, Niels Bohr said something that a lot of people probably want to attribute to Yogi Berra, because it really sounds like something Yogi would have said. Prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future. Well, that's the challenge. So how can we make it more sustainable? Try to work with nature rather than resist it. Include performance confirmation along with compliance monitoring to build model confidence and improve the performance assessment process. So this is what my research is all about. We're trying to get to a point where we have more confidence in the models that we can go from there and maybe not have to monitor in perpetuity. Teaching opportunities. I have a course called Environmental Assessment that covers energy systems and remediation of contaminated sites. I'm interested in sustainable remediation, or let's say more sustainable remediation. And for the past several years, the Environmental Protection Agency has had an initiative called Green Remediation. They have a website. Pretty interesting. I think we're kind of nibbling at the edges of green remediation. For example, this is the Maxi Flats low-level radioactive waste site that turned out to be a real problem and got a lot of attention and remediation. But they're using solar panels to drive the pumps for the groundwater monitoring. So some of these sites are looking at wind energy for some of the functions they have to do. Solar panels, again, just trying to work our way into more sustainable practices, at least at the back end. Because what we really need are technologies that in themselves are sustainable. And that's all I have. So I hope I don't take too long to do that. Thank you.
And our final panelist today is Beth Compton, an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology. Professor Compton received her PhD in 1989 from the University of California at San Francisco and Berkeley. She's a cultural and medical anthropologist specializing in the ethnography of indigenous peoples of lowland South America. Her research focuses on the anthropology of the body, religion and ritual, health and healing, death and mourning, and the politics of indigenous rights, and ecology, environmentalism, and cultural and religious responses to climate change. She teaches courses on anthropological theory, medicine and healing, indigenous peoples, and environmental issues. Her publications include Consuming Grief, Compassionate Cannibalism in Amazonian Society, Body Paint, Feathers, and VCRs, Aesthetics and Authenticity in Amazonian Activism, The Shifting Middle Ground, Brazilian Indians and Ecopolitics, and Environmentalism, Global Community, and the New Indigenism. Professor Compton was also a director for the Center for Study of Religion and Cultures, Ecology, and Spirituality Project.
So what I'm going to do today is to zero in on a few issues related to actually teaching in the classroom that I've encountered. And my experience in this is limited, and I do think one of the things we might talk about is the fact that different kinds of classes in different disciplines and in the sciences versus social sciences and humanities have different dynamics, but I think some of what I'm going to highlight here applies fairly broadly. So my experience with this is in various contexts. In the past, I've taught courses on ecology and international development, and I seem to have environmental sections in most of my classes. There are obvious tie-ins almost everywhere, but courses I do on Amazonia and South America, courses in medical anthropology and the anthropology of healing, all have units that I don't really think of as being directly environmental, but they're germane to the subject matter. More recently, now those are undergraduate courses, so more recently I taught two very different graduate level courses, and one of the things I want to address is some possible differences between undergraduate and graduate teaching around this. One of the graduate programs was in the TIES program for environmental science and engineering students, which Jim Clark and John Ayers also worked with. My course was a social science companion supplement to the science and engineering case study, which was a year-long study of the problems of nuclear waste and, in particular, the Yucca Mountain facilities design. And this involved two spring break trips that I went on to nuclear waste storage facilities in New Mexico and Nevada. So there was also that kind of field teaching and interaction with students. More recently, I taught a more traditional graduate seminar called Values and Environment, which was a hopefully ongoing graduate course that was created by faculty in the Ecology and Spirituality Project at the Center for Religion and Culture. I taught the second iteration of this, a course that was listed in anthropology, but which drew graduate students from a variety of disciplines with very different interests. Right now, I'm in the process of putting together a Maymester course that I'm really excited about called Food Politics in America. So if anybody has ideas, I'm very open right now. So three issues that seem to affect the teaching dynamics of these kinds of environmentally sustainability-focused teaching experiences. that may be present in other kinds of teaching, but I think are really heightened here, are first of all the interdisciplinarity of this kind of teaching. Ecology really is about everything being connected to everything, and I really like Cecilia's highlighting of the social issues and the much larger context of values about what kind of society we want to be, the ties to economics and so on. Almost by definition, any teaching around environmentalism and sustainability that's not very narrowly focused on technical issues or specifically limited to a single discipline or a narrowly defined set of historical issues, it's going to be interdisciplinary, and that has implications. There are so many pressing environmental issues these days that dealing with things that have current relevance is certainly at the top of my priorities, and it's something that students really care about. So the contemporary current nature of things and the fact that a lot of the knowledge is constantly being produced and evolving is another factor here. And then the third factor that I think makes this kind of teaching somewhat distinctive is the salience of personal connections, of personal relevance, of issues that relate to lifestyle, to behavior, and also to activist issues that many students care about. So in reflecting on what I've learned so far along the path of teaching around these sorts of issues, I think that there's something distinctive that's required of the instructor here. I want to also address some of the differences between graduate and undergraduate students, and then to talk about the complex ways that these issues of personal relevance and activism fit into teaching. I like the fact that in starting us out today, John used the word humility, because I think that teaching environmental issues in a comprehensive way requires a certain humility and openness on the part of the instructor, a willingness to venture out of your personal comfort zone, except in these very narrowly defined sort of technical courses. The literature almost by definition is going to be interdisciplinary. Much of it's going to be outside of your own field, and many of the most interesting, challenging issues are unfolding right now. There's constantly new information. It's a challenge to keep up, and journalists get there ahead of academics. So some of the best writing, and particularly for teaching undergraduates, some of the best writing is going to be by journalists. And so you're constantly going to be questioning validity, asking about the solidness of this interpretation, and trying to find the ways to teach your students how to develop critical perspectives on what they read and evaluate the information. We obviously do that in all of our classes, but I think that this is even more of an issue here. I think the humility comes in that you simply have to accept the fact that you can never be totally on top of everything. And students will come from different backgrounds. If you're teaching something that has contemporary relevance, if you're teaching from an interdisciplinary perspective, you're going to attract students who are not just in your own major. They come from different backgrounds. They have their own expertises, and they will know things that you don't know, which is a little unnerving. So I think more than most classes, teaching in this field requires a somewhat more collaborative, less hierarchical relationship between the instructor and the students. The sort of classes that I myself, you know, often teach, which are very tightly controlled, where I'm essentially imparting information, defining the parameters, telling them what's important. Obviously, I'll do some of that, but to a large extent, there's going to be more information flow, more discussion, more collaboration, and I think that trying to create more of a common enterprise of a learning community is part of the goal here. And what we can do is model how to deal with not knowing everything, how to deal with coming up against questions where we don't know the answers. How do we find the answer? How do we evaluate that information? And I also think you need to design these courses with flexibility to follow up on issues that emerge during the course, to adjust the syllabus, to adjust the activities, to design a bit of flexibility and the expectation of some possible changes into the course itself. On the question of differences between graduate and undergraduate courses, I don't think this is absolute, but I do find that graduate students come in with much more focused agendas, and particularly when you're doing a course like Values and Environment, which was specifically designed to draw students from a variety of disciplines into a conversation, the graduate students who come in are there for a specific reason. They're taking a course in another department because they want to get very specific things out of it. And this is great because they bring passion and focus and expertise, but they also want to get certain things. And so in contrast to, say, a graduate seminar in anthropology, where I'm training students to be anthropologists, and they know that the history of the discipline of anthropology, all of the social theory I'm teaching them and so on, is stuff that they're really responsible for and that they're going to, you know, need to be able to use and probably to teach themselves. In this other kind of more interdisciplinary graduate teaching, they probably don't really care that much about my discipline. They're there for their own reasons. And the practical implication that I've found with that is that they are therefore more likely to skimp or to slack off on actually doing the common readings in the depth that I expect in other graduate seminars. It's not that they're bad students, it's just that they're usually doing this as an elective, it's not their main thing, and they want to get what they really need out of it. Because it's, in very technical terms, it's standard procedure in at least the kind of graduate seminars that I teach, that rather than having exams and a lot of structured accountability on the readings and assignments along the way and so on, which is how I at least structure my undergraduate courses, in graduate courses it's much more standard procedure to have their grade based on a single long research paper and project on a topic that they define, which very often is something they've been working on before they ever got into the class. And so consequently, in order to incentivize the kind of engagement with some kind of common readings that will really facilitate a conversation among the students themselves, I've found it's important to think ahead of time about what are going to be the sort of accountability structures, the incentives that will keep everybody up to speed with the readings on a weekly basis. And I think it can be done, but it's something that I've found I have to pay more attention to in these kinds of classes than in others. So you need to think really carefully about what's important, what you want or need to have happen in each class, and also in communications among students outside of classes, which some of the students from the first Values and Environment course are here, and you guys could probably speak to it, but it seems like a certain community developed among you all that the class perhaps created an opening for bringing you together, but recognize that this is one of the most productive things that can happen on campus, I think. And so how do you create the kind of course that's going to allow for that kind of conversation among the students themselves? So finally, there are some really interesting challenges attached to the fact that so many contemporary environmental issues connect to questions of personal lifestyle, political orientations, class identities, economics, consumption practices, and long-running themes in American culture about the discourses of sort of puritanical glee in preaching the evils of materialism and so on and so forth, all cross-cut by issues of class, ethnicity, urban, rural, suburban differences, gender and family situations and so on. This makes environmental issues and sustainability questions incredibly powerful and really fertile for capturing and holding student attention. Everybody can relate to this. Things that are very, very close to home about food and health and the body and environmental contamination and uses of time and family structure and so on, these are very close to home issues. And so it's wonderful because you can really work with this to draw the students in. We all love to talk about our consumer choices. We love to talk about our lifestyles, the complications and the barriers that make it hard to go green, our irritation over other people's behavior, the way that other people talk about these issues, and so on and so forth. So there's a very seductive draw, attraction to focusing on the personal and the relevant. And what I've found is this is just great because people bring passion and interest to this. Everybody can relate. But at the same time, it's difficult to get people off being stuck on these personal issues to really focus seriously on the much larger social issues, the kind that Cecilia was emphasizing. And I think it also makes it difficult for students to approach some topics with enough dispassion or semi-objectivity to actually learn new things. And I raise this because I've seen it happen so many times that classes can so easily get taken over by personal anecdotes or by little rants about, you know, some irritation about how, you know, I remember one graduate seminar where a student just got stuck in dominating the class because CSAs are oriented towards families and the bushel baskets they give you are too big for a single person. And that's a very small example, but there are many, many others where it's so much easier to just talk about the personal relevance issues. And I think as an instructor, you have to create a community in the classroom that has a certain seriousness to it where people are going to be taken out of their comfort zones. They're going to be challenged with perspectives that are not just reinforcing what they already think, and they're going to be held intellectually accountable. So I think this is one of the odd central challenges to use, to intervene as a teacher, to use these personal passions and the anecdotal excursions and the obvious relevance and the connections to activist agendas in ways that we as teachers keep bringing back to focus on really trying to help the students understand new material, understand new ideas, and understand how to learn about these issues.
That was Jack Barkinbus, Cecilia Tishy, James Clark, and Beth Conklin. You can view the show notes as well as leave comments or questions about this episode by visiting blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast. If you'd like to share how you are addressing sustainability in your classroom, we encourage you to stop by our website and join the discussion. Vanderbilt instructors are also welcome to call the Center for Teaching at 322-7290 to arrange a meeting with a CFT teaching consultant. Thanks for listening to the Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching podcast. Please join us for future episodes by visiting the podcast homepage, blogs.vanderbilt.edu/CFTpodcast, or by subscribing to the podcast through iTunes or a similar program. I've been your host, Rhett McDaniel.